Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nikov, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Like many of us, you have gotten the memo. There is no actual division between your online self and reputation and your face-to-face self. No division between personal and public. That is just as true, maybe even more so, if you are a healthcare professional in private practice. Today, you will hear from Dr. John Gavazzi, a clinical psychologist whose podcasts on ethics are approved by the American Psychological Association for Professional Development. Credit. He curates an excellent blog at ethicalpsychology.com, bringing you news of the latest publications on the topic. And they are fascinating, whether this happens to be your field or not. It's great way to keep in touch with some of the advances and some things that don't seem to be advancing. In 2012, John won the Carl F. Heiser APA Presidential Award for Advocacy. And in 2013, he was named Ethics Educator of the Year by Pennsylvania Psychological Association. So we have a great expert on the issues involved, especially in this day and age with the online communication and professional ethics. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Dr. Gavazzi.
Well, Jane, thanks for having me, and thanks for plugging the Ethics and Psychology site.
Oh, well, my pleasure. I enjoy it very much. What can you tell us about the healthcare professionals connecting and communicating in the age of the Internet?
Well, my first suggestion for mental health professionals is to contemplate what you're doing online or on social media before you do anything. You are a professional and you are out on social media or online. The public, including your patients, can find you. So it's very important to remember your professional identity while living online. And my one suggestion at this point is, if you haven't done so yet, you may want to Google yourself to see what comes up. I suggest also moving past page one to see all that's available. I can tell you a funny story about that later if you want.
Okay.
But technology and social media have expanded the ways in which individuals access professionals like you and me, mm-hmm. and specific forms of information about mental health treatment. So many professionals are building an online presence, and there are some issues to contemplate before you go online and develop that online presence.
Okay, well, what are some of the general principles to consider right here at the outset?
Well, it's best to align your online presence with your general professional mission. For example, my general professional mission is to provide high-quality psychological care to patients and their families. Much of what I do follows from that mission. Now, the other component of my professional life is to engage in ethics education with the catchphrase that ethics is more than a code. So when I do ethics education, I talk about a whole variety of issues involved in ethics that, while incorporating the code, go beyond the code. So, for example, I talk a lot about ethical decision-making and biases that occur during psychotherapy.
Okay.
So more back, though, to your original question, what are some of the principles to consider at the outset? First and foremost, what image are you trying to develop when you are online? So, for example, are you trying to hold yourself out as an expert in some area, whether it be forensic work or treating anxiety disorders, or are you using your online presence as part of a larger marketing initiative? So if you are using your online presence for marketing, my suggestion also is to look at your profession's ethics code for psychologists, for those keeping score at home. It's APA code standard 5, when making public statements or engaging in advertising.
Okay.
I think that's the first thing that you want to consider is what image are you trying to develop? The second thing is, you know, how do you plan to do it? So there are many, many, many examples of this. Do you want to have a website with basic information and forms about who you are? And again, this would be kind of like part of the marketing strategy. So, you know, my office address, fax number, how to get in touch with me, you know, my rights and responsibility form, my HIPAA forms. So it could be a fairly static website, and I know a lot of psychologists who have that as part of marketing, and that's perfectly fine. Now, other people want to do more than that. So I do know other psychologists who have blogs as part of their website. And so it's, again, part of their marketing that they write more about what they treat. So maybe they're an expert on depression, or maybe they do mediation work as part of their practice, and they will do blogs, write articles about their experience and their success using certain techniques, whether it's in therapy or through mediation. And yet, other psychologists will go even further than that, and they will try to incorporate then social media with their website. So social media would include things like Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr. So that could also be all part of your online professional identity.
Right, and I suppose that's where it gets a little stickier.
Yes, because when you are out there and you're online, one of the things that I talk with people a lot about are boundaries. And when you're on social media, one of the things that you need to be careful about is that you are not dispensing psychological advice, or you're not doing treatment via Twitter, Tumblr, or Facebook, which has proven to be problematic for some professionals in the past.
Well, I think a lot of people in any profession tend to start with LinkedIn. Can you give us an example on that?
Oh, yes, I can give you an example. First, some good examples, and then I'll give you some not so good examples.
Okay.
So, you know, one example is, you know, I put on through the American Psychological Association's LinkedIn group. So I will put on some of my slide presentations, and I've gotten a lot of positive feedback from folks and have been able to promote the Ethics and Psychology blog that way. Now, LinkedIn is, again, I would classify it as a social media technology, so you need to understand how the technology works before you engage in it.
Mm-hmm.
So a colleague of mine, who's a psychologist, joined LinkedIn. He had his account for several months and really didn't pay attention to it all that much. One day, a message popped up asking him if he would like to add connections to his account.
Right.
The psychologist didn't realize what that meant, and it actually grabbed email addresses from his Gmail account.
Uh-huh.
And they sent out, LinkedIn sent out to current and former patients of his,
uh-huh,
because, again, you're allowed to email patients.
Uh-huh.
So sent out invitations to link with him. And he didn't realize this till a day or so later, a former patient phoned him and said, "I got an invitation from LinkedIn. I'm not sure why you want to link with me."
Uh-huh.
He apologized profusely and then shut down his LinkedIn account very quickly because, again, he did not want to engage in those kind of porous boundaries with current or former patients.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned LinkedIn, because our interviews with Yumi Wilson form a great tutorial on some of the finer points of using LinkedIn. And the one you mentioned is an excellent thing to know right up front and to begin with. But searching thesocialnetworkshow.com will collect all those together for our listeners who want to know more about that. Just look for Yumi Wilson or LinkedIn on our website. What are some of the advantages of using the internet in a one-way fashion like that?
Well, I think that's a great way of beginning to think about your online presence, is that there is one-way communication and then there's two-way communication. So one-way communication is in which, say, a potential patient or a member of the public is looking for information.
Mm-hmm.
So they can Google you or Google Anxiety or whatever, and they can go to certain sites to gather information about whatever it is that they would like to get information about.
So that's a great public service, I think. And before I forget, I want to put in one of my little pet peeves is for someone to list their specialties, and there's a list of like 20 different things. And I wonder, wait a minute, how can you be a specialist across the board? It's sort
right.
of a...
I agree with you completely. I think I don't want to guess at people's motivations, but I think it's hard to be an expert at more than, I would say, two or three things.
Mm-hmm.
So if folks have specialty in, you know, two or three areas, I think you're probably doing very well about that. So I agree. I think when people list that they have 20 specialties, I begin to wonder what is their training, relevant experience, and supervision in terms of those levels of expertise.
And there's also videos, for example, or Vimeo and various film media that people can use. And I think one advantage to that would be that the patient can actually see you talking and get a feel for who you are.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely. I do know some psychologists, and again, I hang out more with psychologists who are actively engaged in types of social media, but they do have videos of themselves online talking about their practice, talking about the way that they do therapy, talking about their mission statement. So that is very good, very positive marketing. So, right, people can see you, hear you, and just get a general sense of do they think they would be a good match with you.
Right, and it always helps if those are up to date, too, of course, because we all know that it's easy to put a outdated photo that is a good one.
That's right.
And then if a person walks in and, you know, they're wondering, where's the person I saw online? We're going to continue with some of these ideas. What other motivations there could be in terms of accenting this social presence online. And we'll do that in the second half of today's interview. I'm Jane Karwoski, and you're listening to The Social Network Show with my guest, Dr. John Gavazzi.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back. As internet technology advances, so does the threat of cybercrime. And the instant you go online, you become vulnerable to dangers such as identity theft, computer viruses, phishing, spyware, and more. In times like these, we must all protect ourselves from cybercrime. Antivirus software, firewalls, and security patches are just the beginning. Never open suspicious emails, only navigate to trusted sites, and change your passwords every 90 days. Backup important files to external storage devices. Tell anyone who uses your computer to be vigilant when downloading from the internet.
Keep your kids safe on the internet. Teach them never to give out personal information or post information about their school or extracurricular activities. Installing parental control software and monitoring their computer are all good ways to prevent cybercrime. To learn more about cybercrime, visit ncpc.org or contact your local law enforcement agency.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show, where I'm chatting with John Gavazzi about the implications of using social media for the professional, and in this case, as an example, the mental health professional. Dr. Gavazzi, we spoke about the professional putting out information for the public so that the public can get to know them. What about the other way around? What are the ethics involved with the professional looking to find out information about their client online?
Right. And I think that is a very large temptation at times on the part of the mental health professional. And as I had said in part one, about self-reflection, that this is another time for mental health professionals to engage in self-reflection, because it's very important for the psychologist to understand, or the mental health professional, I'm sorry, to understand what is the motivation to look up more information about your patient. So when I do ethics workshops, I give this example frequently. So would you ever drive by your patient's house and look in the windows? And yeah. People would say, oh, my God, of course not. I would never do that. So then the follow-up question is, well, then why are you Googling your patient?
Uh-huh.
So it brings into a little bit more focus what is exactly going on in the process. The mental health professional is trying to access information about the patient that the patient hasn't shared yet with the professional. So the next question then after that is, now that you have that information, what are you going to do with it? Because now you have more information about the patient than the patient was comfortable sharing with you.
Mm-hmm. And even though they put it on what is, in principle, a publicly accessible site, they're not expecting you to do that. And isn't it especially important because of the trust being the foundation of that therapeutic relationship?
Absolutely. And along with the trust, I would also go to the concept of informed consent.
Mm-hmm.
Informed consent we review with our patients ahead of time, and again, a good informed consent document would include defining what the roles and the responsibilities of the psychologist and the patient are, what are the potential risks and harms, what forms of communication, confidentiality, costs, those kinds of good things. So those are all elements of informed consent. Now, if you would tell a patient up front, hey, as part of my treatment, I'm going to Google you, and then the person reads that, you discuss it, and they say, oh, that's okay, then I think you're okay, but I don't know anybody, literally, I don't know any clinical person who has as part of their informed consent that they are going to Google the patient. Now, with the slight caveat to that last statement is there are some forensic mental health professionals who will say as part of a forensic or legal evaluation that they are going to go online and Google the person or look up information on that person online. So I'm really trying to make a hard and fast distinction between doing clinical work, which, again, I don't think I've ever heard of anybody putting that in informed consent versus a forensic or legal evaluation, where I do know mental health professionals do that type of work.
Well, now, the fact that it's not spelled out in informed consent, do you think that is basically saying that the clinician is not going to seek other forms of information or try to get more information than the patient actually or the client actually gives them during the session?
Well, Well, I would think that, yes, I would think that that is the unspoken rule, is that if it's not in the informed consent, it's probably not a good idea for the mental health professional to engage in that kind of behavior. So if something does come up, and again, I'm completely making this a hypothetical where the mental health professional believes it's appropriate as part of treatment, and again, I'm trying to struggle to come up with a reason why it would be appropriate in treatment, to Google the patient, then you need to talk about that, document that as part of informed consent, and then go ahead and Google the patient. But absent the informed consent, I really do believe that it's a huge boundary violation. It's an invasion of their privacy, and it can be extremely detrimental to the therapeutic relationship.
How is confidentiality affected by things like emails or Facebook, Twitter, direct messages, and so forth?
It is very much affected. These are between session contacts, and again, when I do ethics education, I talk about these between session contacts, and it's perfectly okay for mental health professionals, text, email, kind of routine types of information, like, hey, when's my appointment? I forgot. Is it at 3 or 4 today? Those types of pieces of information are completely legitimate, and again, with informed consent, because, you know, these texts are not completely confidential and emails are not completely confidential. So if you're not giving out any kind of protected health information, I think that the clinician is fine engaging in those kinds of activities.
There could be a situation, just using my imagination here, where the professional doesn't reveal anything specific to what they are seeing the client for. But the client may not realize the need to be closed-mouthed about that. I'm just imagining a client who then starts to get ads for an antidepressant on their online. So they may have mentioned that they were feeling depressed, or maybe their depression is lifting or something like that in an email. But those are scraped for information about what kind of ads could be targeted toward a person. So imagine that feeling. They may wonder.
Right. And I think that if a client sends you information about something, that's, from my perspective, not yet protected health information. So they're saying, hey, I'm feeling really depressed today. Can I have my appointment's in 2 weeks. You know, can I have a quicker appointment? I would, try to get them in more quickly and say, hey, you don't have to go into detail. All you have to do is say, I need, an appointment more quickly. You don't have to put anything about your signs or symptoms. If you say in an email, I need an appointment more quickly, I get the message. You don't need to go into that detail. So it would be more of a teachable moment type of thing about how to use telecommunications more confidentially. I don't think that's a huge HIPAA breach. I don't think that's a huge clinical problem. But again, just kind of teaching clients what's confidential, what's private, and what's not can sometimes be very helpful.
What kind of, now you promised us a funny story. I think it was about at the beginning
Googling
of our
myself.
Conversation. Okay.
right, Googling myself. So there happens to be an individual in Green, New York, who shares my name, who was involved in a child pornography case. And he's roughly my age, so this happened three, four years ago. I'm in my early 50s now. But I had somebody call me on the phone and, ask how long I've been in practice, where I've lived before, what my areas of specialty are. And, typically I get those, kinds of questions. But this person was really asking me about New York. Mm-hmm. And that's what I said was, are you concerned that I'm the same John Gavazzi in Green, New York, who has child pornography cases? And they were like, yes, how did you know? And I was like, well, that's because I've Googled myself. Mm-hmm. So that actually did come up one time previously. So it is good to go past the first page to see what else is out there about you.
Right, very. And that would raise some red flags and start them waving furiously, wouldn't it? Are there any additional points that you want to make for our listeners today?
Well, I just want to reemphasize the idea that mental health professionals, psychologists, social workers all need to understand the technology as well as the limitations of that technology before they engage in it. I do get lots of emails, phone calls, questions about how to set up a blog, how to set up a Twitter account, how to set up a Tumblr account. I'm not an expert on Facebook. I do have a Facebook page, but I just don't like the whole format. I think it's very important that you understand the technology beforehand, that you feel comfortable with the technology, and that you understand why you're using that technology in order to fulfill whatever your professional mission is. So I think if people are contemplating, how does my presence online match up with my professional mission, I think those are some good ideas to contemplate before going online and becoming involved in social media.
Go ahead.
I would just say the only other thing, too, is that you're going to make mistakes. So just because you make a mistake doesn't mean it's the end of the world. Like I gave you the example of LinkedIn, the psychologist remediated his situation immediately. He made a mistake. He's decided never to join LinkedIn. So I think you can still recover from making some of these mistakes. And just because you make a mistake on social media doesn't automatically mean you're going to face a licensing board complaint or a lawsuit.
Mm. Well, thank you. Those are all great ideas and food for thought for all professionals so that they can tailor their own practice to this new wired world, whatever
right.
it might be. And
right.
So thank you, Dr. Gavazzi, for taking time to talk with us today on the Social Network Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
And many thanks to you, our listener, for joining us today. Please also give a listen to 50shows.com, that's 50shows.com, to hear important interviews with, for, and about women worldwide with dreams to live. If you are listening by way of iTunes, please add us to your playlist. And thank you for telling your friends about the Social Network Show, where you hear commentary and analysis of our connected networked world, including practical advice from top business and marketing mentors, news from people combating cyberbullying and abuse, as well as experts on privacy, surveillance, and women and girls empowerment online. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us via questions at thesocialnetworkstation.com. Please let me know what you like and any changes you'd like to hear on the show. Please have fun and be safe online and off until we welcome you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on the Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.